happy Friday. I'm Babs Rawls Ivy, and you've just tuned in to Criminal Justice Insider with Babs Rawls Ivy and Jeff Grant. Jeff Grant is on medical, on a medical leave right now, so he cannot be here, but I bet you he's listening. So he is recuperating, and get well, Jeff. Usually my backup, Andrew Kaplan, my love and friend, somewhere in the hills of Guatemala. So he can't be here either. So I'm riding solo. I'm doing this thing solo. And today's show, Criminal Justice Insider, is brought to you by the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven and Family Reentry. So I'm welcoming William Carbone, or people call you Bill?
They do.
People call you Bill. Bill Carbone, who is the director of TOE Youth Justice Institute and the director of experiential education. So Erica Nowakowski was going to be here today, but she has other duties and commitments in Hartford today. So it's just Bill riding shotgun today, doing his thing. So this program is at the University of New Haven, UNH, and we're going to talk a lot about criminal justice, because I hear, if anybody knows anything about youth criminal justice, it is you.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'll do the best I can.
Your reputation precedes you, let me tell you. People were very excited that you were going to be here and hearing this conversation.
Thank you.
So what do we know? What do we get right about? What do we get right about youth and incarceration and reform and justice and all of that in Connecticut? Where were we and where are we?
We get a lot right about it. As a matter of fact, Connecticut is leading the nation in many respects in juvenile justice reform. We've learned a lot in the last couple of decades about the impact of involvement with the police and involvement with the courts. And the more kids have contact with those parts of the system, all the research teaches us that they're more likely to keep coming back and their offenses will escalate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's largely due to the labeling that they feel from the contact to the with the system, and that kids tend to live up to what they think are society's expectations of them. So we're diverting a tremendous number of kids now from the system through things like the the juvenile review boards in the state, the youth services bureaus, and that's all good. A second thing we've learned is that incarceration, while it serves the purpose of incapacitating children temporarily, it does them long-term harm.
Mm-hmm.
It's very traumatic to remove kids from their homes and from their communities and to put them in a environment where they're caged and where, in fact, the only others with whom they have contact are all kids who have some antisocial tendencies. They actually come out worse than when they went in.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Connecticut, we've closed the only prison for children, thanks to the work of Governor Malloy and the state's Juvenile Justice Policy and Oversight Council. The Connecticut Juvenile Training School in Middletown closed officially on April 1st. So now, instead of incarcerating kids in prisons, the state is moving toward a small community-based group home type programs that have lots of support services and treatment and lots of contact with the community. That's a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
A third thing that I would say that we've learned and we're leading the nation on are status offenders. These are the kids who typically have been sent to courts for things like truancy, for running away from home, for being out of control of their parents. They're not violating the law, but they're exhibiting some troublesome behaviors. And typically those cases would end up in the juvenile court. And so for the first time, Connecticut is saying, we're not going to send these kids to juvenile court, because that's going to label them, make them feel like they are delinquent, even though they're not committing criminal offenses. And the research, by the way, does support that. And so now those cases are being funneled by the referral agents instead to social services. So in many, many respects, Connecticut has been achieving some great, great reforms. And by the way, none of this is at the expense of public safety, Overall crime is way down in our state. It's at a 40-year low. Crimes committed by children are equally at historic lows. So Connecticut is really in a good place. That's really what gives rise to the creation of the Tau Youth Justice Institute at the University of New Haven.
The and how old is the Tau?
It's 4 years old.
Oh, so this is very, very new.
It's new, yes. The Tau Foundation, which was founded by the Tau Foundation, by the Tau family from New Canaan, Connecticut. They're a wonderful, generous, caring group of people. And they invest their funds in a variety of different charitable causes, including medical research and cultural arts, but also juvenile justice. And they were concerned that the achievements that we were making in juvenile justice, the reforms, could be lost over time, because this is a system that operates in relative secrecy to protect the confidentiality of kids. And so they wanted to create an institute, and they chose the University of New Haven to do this, where we could conduct research, we could do planning, we can work on problem solving, we can organize appropriate training, and continue to keep the issue of reform of the juvenile justice system on the radar screen in Connecticut. And that started on October 2nd of 2014. Since then, many, many others have joined the Institute, including the state of Connecticut, numerous foundations, and the federal government as well.
Now, we had Dr. Danielle Cooper on in one of the early shows, and she was really talking about a lot of the statistical stuff and how really changing the way that we monitor and deal with children in the justice system. I guess before these sweeping changes, you know, we were almost treating children as if they were adults, and with no sort of opportunity for reform. You know, so you would see this revolving door kind of thing with kids. Kids grow up to be adults. If they're not addressed at the youth level, then you'll have to make some adjustments or address it when they actually go to prison for grown-ups. So this is pretty groundbreaking work to sort of jump in this school-to-prison pipeline at this juncture, right? Like, because you could jump in anywhere, but y'all are jumping in at the earliest possible point.
So I'm glad that you used that term, school-to-prison pipeline. So I have a plaque on my desk, and it's been there for 30 years, and it's some very inspiring words by Frederick Douglass, the author and diplomat, abolitionist. And he said, it's better to build strong children than to repair broken men.
Yes.
And I think that's...
And that's still true.
Very, very much true, and very much the motto of our Tau Youth Justice Institute. Schools... were in fact contributing significantly to the school-to-prison pipeline. How were they doing that? Well, it has to do with how they were handling incidents in the school. And many schools had moved toward what we would call zero tolerance.
And what does that mean?
What it means is any incident that for which there's any probable cause that a crime has occurred, call the police and arrest the child and bring them to the police department, book them, go through all that. So, for example, we did a study and found that there were lots of kids being sent to court for breach of peace and for disorderly conduct. When you peel the layers back and said, what was that all about? Well, there were minor fights between kids in schools. Nobody got hurt. Things that in years ago, they would have been settled by a visit to the principal's office, in school detention. Sometimes, you know, confrontations occur. Kids refuse to take their hats off in class. They get into shouting matches. They were things that could be handled and should be handled within a disciplinary system for the school. And sometimes, you know, they need to call in other resources to deal with kids who are spiraling out of control. Mental health resources that are available in the community. So a lot of effort has been made in the state of Connecticut And I really give credit to the State Department of Education, to the Child Health and Development Institute in Connecticut, to try to infuse more restorative justice practices.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean opportunities for the student to receive some sanction for his behavior, but at the same time not have him arrested and referred to the court.
So, Bill, was the state already moving in this direction before you all showed up, or did you provide the tipping point? Like, did you provide a bigger catalyst for which they could embrace?
No, the state was clearly moving in this direction. We had a juvenile justice system, but that back in the late 1990s and clearly into the 2000s was, the detention part of it was under federal court consent judgment for conditions of confinement that were in violation of human rights.
Mm-hmm.
We had just built an enormous prison for kids capable of holding 250 kids. No, it was not a good system. But over a period of 15 years, many, many improvements had taken place. I was in the judicial branch. I was head of juvenile probation and juvenile detention and other functions in those days. And that's really why the Institute was created. It shouldn't depend upon people who have passion and who have commitment to helping kids to be in the right place at the right time. It ought to be an ongoing thing, regardless of who the leaders are.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why Tao invested in creating this entity at the University of New Haven. And at the same time, Representative Tony Walker, who in my opinion is the leader in our state on juvenile justice reform.
Absolutely.
I often say to her that when they write the book about juvenile justice reform, it's going to be written in two parts, before Tony Walker and after Tony Walker.
Because she was out there at first alone.
She was.
And no one wanted to hear about kids.
Well, you know, a very important thing took place this week, this month in Vermont. Vermont was the first state to raise the juvenile age above 18. They raised it to 19. But a few years ago, Tony Walker took that on in the state of Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, along with Senator Tony Harp at that time, and to raise the age from 16 to 17, and then from 17 to 18, that was a battle.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of only three states in the country that had the age of adulthood at 16.
Because people felt some kind of way. Like, people really felt that you know, if you were a 16-year-old committing crimes, you ought to...
Yeah.
Be treated like an adult.
They did, but we were in receipt of what the modern neuroscience teaches us, which is that the brain develops slowly over the teen years.
Yes.
And that the last section of the brain to develop, which is the frontal lobe, is really where all the decision making. So when we think about the impulsiveness of kids during their teenage years, it's because that section of the brain is still unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony certainly understood that, but she also understood that we were not getting good results in the adult system from 16 and 17-year-olds. They had very high failure rates. They had very high recidivism rates. And I think it's what happens when you put 16 and 17-year-olds in the same system where you have 35-year-olds and they're
yeah.
in programs together. So not only did she move these kids into the juvenile system, but she also built age-appropriate programming into that system. And we're getting excellent results.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll share this with you. If you do this, you would expect and should expect fewer 18 to 21-year-olds in the adult system. Because if they're functioning effectively in the juvenile system, the purpose of it should be to prevent recidivism, which would bring them into the adult system. Since we have raised the age in Connecticut, The number of 18 to 21-year-olds incarcerated in the State Department of Correction has dropped by 62%.
Wow.
Enormous drop.
Wow.
So that tells me it vindicates the policy of raise the age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think back to the many fights and struggles we had during those years. And really, Representative Tony Walker... deserves a tremendous amount of credit.
So, Bill, do you think people were afraid that, I mean, even though you present people with the scientific data and you say, you know, this is what it is, there still was these big fights. And so do you think people were really afraid, or, I mean, well, I'm trying to understand.
Yeah. You know, I teach juvenile justice, and oftentimes in my class, and when we talk about this whole issue of raise the age, I get this response from the students. Well, I knew right from wrong when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy, I suppose, to come to that conclusion. But I urge the students then to think about not themselves, but the clinical history of the kids that typically come into the system. And when you peel the layers back, what you find is really a lot of educational failure. Academic failure is probably the most common denominator among these kids. High level of dysfunction mm-hmm. in the family. You find that they don't have positive leisure time activities. Many of them, by the way, have substance abuse issues. Some suffer from depression, anxiety, other kinds of mental health issues. So the development isn't exactly normal.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at the 16-year-olds and say, oh, yeah, I knew what I was doing back then, let's not try to compare everybody to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't all had the same history. We haven't all experienced the same degree of trauma and the effects of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to then put that into context of neuroscience and have to understand that this is still a time when things are developing. And, you know, I could say to those same students, you're here on campus. Have you ever done anything that breaks the law? Oh, you know, of course, then they think back, you know, did they exceed the speed limit? You know, there's various ways. Well, of course, you know, so we have to just kind of separate it from ourselves and try to understand this group and their age development.
Mm-hmm. So how much attention do you pay to race and culture and ethnicity and those kinds of demographics?
Well, I think that remains a major challenge in the juvenile justice system. We have had a lot of success at reducing the number of kids that come into the system. Tremendous amount of success. Where we haven't experienced the same level of success is with disproportionate minority contact.
Mm-hmm.
It still remains. And the deeper you get into the system, the more disproportionate the minority representation of the population is. So you get into detention, you get into the, you know, incarceration portion, and the vast majority of it
mm-hmm.
is Black or Hispanic. So that remains something that we need to look at and examine more carefully and really try to craft some culturally competent solutions. I remain concerned, and I think part of it is that the police practices may be different in locations where many minorities live, so they tend to get arrested. Mm-hmm. To a far greater extent than if you live in the suburbs. Or mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the behaviors are different.
Mm-hmm.
It simply means the potential for arrest is greater. Where you have a lot of density of housing, you have an awful lot of people that can see or hear things. Where in the suburbs, that doesn't happen. So kids in the cities in particular are at greater risk for involvement with the system. And that's where I think we really have to begin to work at what are the signs, and how can we prevent them from having contact at all?
So what brings you to this work, Mr. Carbone?
Well, I've been in the system for over 40 years. I worked in the state government in many, many positions. I worked for Governor Grasso, for Governor O'Neill. For many years, I did work actually expanding the adult prison system in the 1980s. And then I went to the Judicial Department, and my job in the Judicial Department was to develop what they called alternative sanctions, and these are giving the judges choices. You don't have to send Johnny to jail. Well, what can we do for Johnny? Well, we can put him in what we called an AIC, Alternative Incarceration Center. There he's going to get help with job. He's going to get help with substance abuse. He's going to get help with anger management. And what I saw over those years was that the people that went into the programs had significantly lower recidivism rates than those that we'd send to jail.
Mm-hmm.
So while we were punishing people, certainly by removing them from the community and putting them in jail, we were not really changing their behavior. And I thought about, well, what if this was a private company and 3 out of 4 of the products that we made came back to us 3 years later because they were defective and we had to replace them? That company would be out of business. But you look at the recidivism rate, the rearrest rate for those who go to jail, it's very high. It's somewhere in the 2 out of 3 get rearrested. So it should tell us, and it's nothing. This is certainly not a criticism of the Department of Correction. I think it's just the culture of being in an institutional setting versus being in the community. So I know we need prisons, but I think they need to be the absolute last resort. And I think the best chance, based on all my experience and what I know about research, is that the best chance we have for changing behavior is when we keep people in their natural ecology and their community connected as much as possible to support systems like family or school or employment or other services. And that really was a very important conversion for me,
mm-hmm.
to be there. And then, of course, when I went to the Court Support Services Division in the judicial branch, and had the chance to manage juvenile detention, juvenile probation, as well as adult probation, I made behavior change the principal mission. So I'm very, very much committed to that. And I really do think it's important to spend your time on the juvenile system. The extent to which we're successful there clearly means that we won't have to deal with individuals in the adult system when it's infinitely harder to change their behavior.
So what's the blowback, Bill, on this? So if you put things in place for juveniles and the citizens would say, the voting citizens would say, well, you know, why are you spending our tax dollars doing these kinds of things when we have perfectly good schools? Why can't these kids go to school and do what they're supposed to do? And why are we, you know, warehousing kids? You know, why are we trying to do all these things in jail? Jail is about punishment, and they need to learn and be punished for what they do. And how do you fight that blowback? Do you? Because I know you hear it,
yep.
And I know you're up against it when you try to sort of, you know, insert another kind of thinking around how we do this work.
You know, we all want the same thing. We want safe communities. We want to be able to feel safe in our homes and our neighborhoods. The question is, how do we get there? And I don't consider anything I do as soft on crime. I consider it as smart on crime. Because if we over-relied on incarceration, we know it's not going to get us changed behavior. We know those people are going to come back to our community, and they're, in fact, more likely to be a menace.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if we have other models that show that we can be effective, spend a lot less money, by the way, on community-based programs, and longer term be more effective in terms of the safety of the community where we all live, why wouldn't we do that? That is much smarter on crime. And the other thing I would say to people who say, well, that, you know, they can go to a public school, why aren't they getting education? So my experience with a lot of these kids is it's opportunity. They don't all have the same opportunity. They don't all have the same preparation before school starts. Many of these kids do not have two parents living at home. And many of them do not have a solid parental structure at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I often tell my students, I remember my mom used to come in the bedroom, make sure we got up
mm-hmm.
to go to school. And unless you had a fever, you went to school. All right?
We had the same mother.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, not all kids have
that's
that.
True.
And then, you know, a lot of kids tend to be absent. And maybe it's that, you know, the parents are working. The parents can't get them to school in an organized way. And they fall behind.
Mm-hmm.
And when you fall behind, school becomes a very negative experience.
Yeah.
When you've missed the foundation for grade 3, but you're in grade 3 and you're struggling, and every time you get your papers back, it's all X's or, you know, and you see others that are doing well, do you want to go? Do you want to go and be in that situation every day. And then so we see this pattern that kids do poorly in school, and then they tend to get relegated perhaps to other special education programs, and they mix with other kids who are similarly situated. And then they as a group stop going. And when they're not going to school, where are they? They're in the community. What are they doing? Well, they're still in their adolescent years. They're thinking about how can we find excitement, get a thrill, get some money. And we see the beginnings of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, education is key. And we need to look at some of the barriers to education. And that's where we can be very effective at helping those families that are struggling to get their kids to school, to get them to do their homework, and to get them to be active parents in the educational system.
So how far, how expansive and far is your reach? Do you engage community partners? Do you engage them in this work? Do you say, listen, you know, we have this, but we know we can't do that. So y'all do that. Can y'all get to the table? And how can we have a comprehensive and holistic conversation about what needs to happen? How do we stop this school to pipeline, prison to pipeline?
You know, we do our business in a number of ways, but our job mainly is to move reform along.
Mm-hmm.
So let's think about the current juvenile justice system. How do we build reformers into that system? So every year we have an institute. It's called the Transforming Leaders Institute. And we invite people to apply. It's a 9-month institute. People come for a day and a half a month to the University of New Haven. These are middle-level people that work in the public agencies and many of the private agencies that serve juveniles and their families. And over a period of 9 months, they learn how to be leaders. They learn how to be advocates. They learn all about best practices in the juvenile justice system. They have to do a capstone project so that they bring it back to their agency and bring it to fruition. And the idea is that over a period of 5 years, we will have somewhere around 80 to 100 people in the system dedicated to reform.
Wow.
So
that's pretty innovative.
It is. It's a wonderful
that's
way.
We're innovative.
We're into the third year of this. We've already graduated the first two classes. Those mm-hmm. people are active in the system advancing reform. Another thing that we've done, and you had Dr. Danielle Cooper on, who is, in my opinion, one of the finest researchers that we ever could have found. I recruited her from the state of Florida and brought her here. She's the director of research at the Tao Institute.
Oh, she is amazing.
She's wonderful.
I want her on more because she really just brought it home for us.
Yeah.
And people were just amazed at the information.
She's great. But let me tell you what she did. She completely revamped our curriculum in juvenile justice at the University of New Haven. And we created a brand new concentration that's being promoted now to incoming students. And the idea of it is over a 4 or 5 year period, we recruit more young people to come to the University of New Haven because they want to study and because they want to be a part of the activities of the Tao Youth Justice Institute. That's the way we affect reformers in the future juvenile justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's already beginning to take hold at UNH. A third thing that we're doing is we're really reaching out to private nonprofits throughout the state that work with troubled children and their families. We're about to begin a service learning course with the Clifford Beers Clinic in New Haven.
Mm-hmm.
But we place for internships and co-ops our students in many of the agencies, like the Juvenile Probation System, Department of Children and Families. I mentioned Clifford Beers, the Connecticut Junior Republic, the Community Solutions, the Wheeler Clinic, all these places where they could learn from practitioners over the course of a semester and therefore become more competent and more passionate about juvenile justice. The final way in which we fulfill our mission is through something called the Juvenile Justice Policy and Oversight Council.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very active group. It's headed by Representative Walker
mm-hmm.
and Secretary Ben Barnes, who's the governor's budget chief. They meet every month on the third Thursday of the month. All of their meetings are televised on CTN. But they have it's approximately 35 people that are on this commission, and they work on the areas of diversion, incarceration reduction, recidivism reduction, and now they're beginning to tackle the critical issues of education and of opening up vocational education opportunities for kids. So our work is pretty diverse. We brought in a consultant just recently. We want to create an institute in 2019 where we invite police leaders to come to the University of New Haven over several months, a couple of days a month, to learn about adolescent brain, to learn about adolescence itself, and to learn about some innovative ways of bringing police and youth together in ways that build trust rather than build hostility.
That's a good, that's, I think that's very needed, because I don't think when police officers are trained, that is not part of the training.
That's correct. And you know, it's not part of the, it's a very small part of the training, as we learned. Legislature passed a law a couple of years ago saying that there had to be training in the pre-service area around this issue, but it's 3 hours mm-hmm. in the course of a, you know, several month training program. Yeah. It's really not enough when you consider the fact that anybody under 18 is now a juvenile.
Yeah.
So do all the police really understand about brain development? Do they understand about some of the unique histories of these kids? Do they understand, you know, the signs of spiraling out of control because of mental health issues mm-hmm. when it might be more appropriate to call the emergency mobile crisis team from DCF in rather than handcuff them or taser them and bring them to jail?
And we've seen a lot of that in the news play out.
Yes.
And I know that must have been quite shocking to you. At least it was shocking to me that oftentimes that would be the first, that'd be the first thing they do rather than call in. You know, like yeah. if somebody's on a roof, we call in the SWAT team.
Yeah.
We don't shoot them down to get yeah. them down. We call the SWAT team and somebody, or we call the people who talk people from jumping down. You know, they don't shoot them first. They no. talk to them. So I think that should be the same. We should afford the same concept to kids who are spiraling.
Yeah. And we're trying to do this in the schools as well. Because sometimes some kids just, they have very low self-control.
Yeah.
So how much education do we really give SROs, the school resource officers, or teachers on when it's important to call in those kinds of specialists because they're better equipped to deal with the incident than teachers or SROs? But in respect to the police, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the
I do
police.
Too. I served as a police yeah. commissioner here in the
yeah.
city. So
yeah.
I do, yes.
And I know when you have to make a spur-of-the-moment judgment, you know, I wouldn't want every one of my spur-of-the-moment judgments yeah. question. But I do think, you know, we need more training. And I've talked to police officers who are aware of some of my beliefs about juvenile justice. And they say, you know, I feel like, you know, my hands are tied because if we arrest them, the courts are probably going to just throw it out. You know, the system's too easy. We need to make it tougher. And I don't think there's enough education on what we've learned mm-hmm. about children and about the best ways of developing good relationships with them and helping them to be better citizens of our nation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. So who out there, when you're thinking about doing all these kinds of things, and I know you must pay attention to what's going on across the country and around the world. Who out there is doing innovative stuff that you find interesting enough to sort of like, you know what, we could make that happen here, or mm-hmm. let me borrow some of that. What have you seen out there that looks like it's working or worthy of a second look?
Okay, well, the state of Massachusetts this year raised the minimum wage. Age. So in the state of Connecticut, the minimum age for being arrested as a juvenile is 7.
Mm-hmm.
Think about a 7-year-old. Now, I have grandchildren, 7 grandchildren, and, you know, 3 or 4 of them are already past the age of 7, but I couldn't conceive of them being arrested and understanding the arrest process and being brought to the police department and going through you know, fingerprinting and processing and being held. And very smartly, the state of Massachusetts said, we think if kids are committing crimes under the age of 12, this is really a responsibility that should go to the Child Protection Agency, the DCF, for example, not putting these kids through the justice system.
Yeah, because that could be lasting. I mean, that's a lasting, you know, that's a trauma, I think.
Absolutely. Well, there's evidence that it's traumatic. And what's the effect of the trauma? The trauma weakens them mm-hmm. and makes them more susceptible to similar behavior. So they very smartly raised that age to 12. You know, my sense is they're doing that better than the state of Connecticut, where ours is 7. And I think that's an area where we should examine that minimum age and say, do we really think 7, 8, 9-year-old kids should be arrested and sent to court? Or is there a better way to deal with them?
Mm-hmm.
Second thing I would say is the state of Vermont just raised their maximum age up to 19. Why 19? Well, they said that there's a lot of kids in high school who don't necessarily graduate because they're 18.
Right.
So let's at least take this one step at a time and say, by the age of 19, pretty much they're out of high school. So they're either working, in college, doing something else. I think that was smart. They couldn't get it all the way to 21, but they started.
Mm-hmm.
Get some practice at that, produce some data, show that it can be more effective than putting 19-year-olds into the adult system, and then you could raise the age higher. I think we can learn from that experience. The state of Missouri, some years ago, decided not to put kids in institutional settings, instead to invest in smaller group home type facilities. And by the way, I would also point you to the city of New York, which some years ago created what's called the Close to Home Initiative,
mm-hmm.
where they took the city of New York's kids that were institutionalized in the juvenile justice system, in prisons in effect, and they put them all into smaller community-based group home type facilities, varying levels of security, and they've had a very positive outcome from that experience. So if you look around the country, there's many examples of reforms that I think give us good things to consider. But I will also say we have to blow our own horn here in Connecticut. Many other states are looking at us.
Mm-hmm.
How did you close your only state prison? How'd you get the legislature to agree to that kind of thing? How did you completely decriminalize status offenders? How did you get your detention system to have a population low enough that you closed one of the three centers and the other two centers are basically three quarters empty? What kind of changes in the criteria that judges use to detain kids did you make? How did you get people to buy into the whole notion of diversion? In other words, rather than arresting kids, sending them to an organized informal program to deal with that. So we're being looked at in a number of different areas ourselves.
Mm-hmm. If you just tuned in, I'm Babs Rawls-Ivey, and this is Criminal Justice Insider with Babs Rawls-Ivey and Jeff Grant. Jeff is on medical leave at the moment, and I'm sitting here with William Carbone from the University of New Haven. He's a senior lecturer and executive director of justice programs and the director of the Tau Youth Justice Institute and director of experiential education at the University of New Haven. And so we're having this wonderful conversation supported by the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven and Family Reentry. So, all right, so there's some progress going on here. Are you at all concerned, Bill, about political whims and political climate? Do you concern yourself with that?
Sure. And I think that's why the argument for juvenile justice has to be made not based on intuition, not based on gut feelings, but it needs to be data driven.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you're Democrat or Republican, my experience is you want good public safety. And if you can show people, those on the conservative side, for example, that this makes sense, and by that I mean dollars and cents, because if we invest in kids on the front end of the system, we save substantially on the deeper end of the system. It's not cheap to incarcerate children. In the state of Connecticut, a couple of years ago, this was looked at. To keep one child incarcerated was costing us about $350,000 per year.
Wow.
Now, think about that. And think about that kind of an investment yielding the outcome where a year or two later, three out of four of them got rearrested. And you'd say, what was the benefit to the public of spending all that money? Okay, well, do you have an alternative? Yeah, we do have an alternative. We can keep kids closer to their home communities. We can keep them in privately run residential programs. We can fill those programs with the right blend of support services. It could be significantly cheaper, maybe a fifth of the cost of incarceration. And we can get better outcomes as measured by lower rearrest rates. So it seems to me that if you're Democrat or you're Republican, saving money is important, but also public safety is important.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them are happy with high recidivism rates.
Mm-hmm.
So the value of our institute, by the way, is that we have access to the professors. We have access to PhD students. We have access to master's level students. The university is enormously supportive of this institute. So we can bring a vast array of academic resources around problems. People like Dr. Cooper, for example, who you've met, we can bring them together, collect all the data that's needed, analyze that data, and then come up with recommendations that we can make that are sound and workable.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So before we go, we got about 5 minutes. What is the bigger picture? What if you could have everything that you want for this institute, for the Tao Justice Institute, what's the dream? What's the big end game?
Well, of course, we'd love to be putting ourselves out of business, right? Because if we didn't have kids that were at risk, you wouldn't need us. You wouldn't need a juvenile justice system. But let's be more realistic. Our dream in the future is that we can make our educational system in our state more equitable, that no matter where a kid lives, he has access to and he has real opportunity. It's not just access, because the school may be there. It's some of the barriers that prevent kids from being successful in schools. I indicated earlier academic failure is probably the most common denominator among the kids that we see. I truly believe that if we can get each kid to feel and value education and to do well in school, that's the most significant thing that we can do to prevent kids from ever, ever even being at risk of coming into the juvenile system. The second thing I would say is we need functioning families. And where we have families that are struggling, and whether it's struggling from domestic violence or from substance abuse or from alcohol abuse or mental health issues.
Or economic.
And economic issues, for sure. And, you know, I said, academic failure is a common denominator. So is poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So is educational failure. So is dysfunctional homes. We need those kinds of supports in the community. And I really dream about us being able to demonstrate. We're saving the state a lot of money when we close a prison that was costing $350,000 per year per kid.
Ooh.
Wouldn't it be great if we could invest some of that savings into the communities from which most of these kids are coming?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the kids that are getting into the deep end of the system, like it or not, it's the big cities. But what if we took some of that savings and we reinvested it on the front end of those communities? In economic development, and we reinvested it in educational supports, we reinvested it in jobs, we reinvested it in helping those families to be better functioning. So that's my dream.
That's a good dream.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good dream, Bill. I like it. It's
I quoted Frederick Douglass mm-hmm. before, and I'll quote him again. It's better to build strong children than to repair broken men. So throughout my, more than 40 plus years in the system, I truly believe in that, having spent a lot of time trying to deal with broken men, and I realize how hard it is. And by the way, I'm going to give a tremendous amount of credit to Commissioner Scott Semple, our current Commissioner of Corrections.
He was on early this
year. Nobody has done more to try to help people who are incarcerated in my years of experience than him. He's been absolutely terrific. But it's difficult to change people in an institutional environment, and we have to try to work on them mm-hmm. when they're in the juvenile system.
Well, Carbone, it was a pleasure talking to you today.
My pleasure.
I enjoyed this, and I appreciate that there's this kind of thinking out here around young people, not just lock them up and throw them away, but to really think about what they need and how we as a community could support this work, and how organizations like the Tao Youth Foundation could, justice can wrap, do their part to help train people to be reformers from the institutional perspective, from the inside out.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you come back.
Invite me.
All right. Thank you, Harry. Thank you, Jeff Grant. Feel better. Get well. Andrew, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Love y'all. And Greater New Haven for the Community Foundation, thank you. And Family Reentry, thank you for making this show possible today.